should do it in a tie.
Wait a minute. I want to know about this lumbar thing.
You'll have
how
to ask for a training about
that.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to get started. Good evening and welcome to the Tuesday, October 3rd, 2006, Carrboro Board of Aldermen regular board meeting. Before we get started, we've got a few brief items. The first thing I would like to recognize Town Manager Steve Stewart.
A couple of new employees who are here tonight that I wanted to introduce to the board and to the public. First is Nancy Inslee, our new accounting officer. Nancy here. Nancy. And Sandy Savoda, who's our purchasing officer, budget analyst. Sandy's been with us a little bit longer on a temporary basis, but she just recently attained permanent status with the town. So I'd like to welcome both of them.
Well, welcome to both of you, and thank you for joining our staff. And I wanted to mention, I noted that as of sometime last month, Johanna Hassan, who has worked with Roy Green in the Buildings and Maintenance Division for the Public Works of the Town of Carrboro, retired in September. And after, I think I have this right, after some 19 years of service with the Town of Carrboro, and I just wanted to say, and actually we're having a retirement party for him later this month, but I wanted to say thank you to Mr. Hassan for all of that work. 19 years is shows a lot of dedication to the town of Carrboro. And I would also like to just briefly mention that the Bowling Creek Festival will be a week from this Saturday, Saturday, October 14th at Umstead Park. I think it starts
at
1 o'clock. And the day before that, voter registration will end for the 2006 election cycle. So if you are not registered to vote yet in Orange County, you can register at a number of different locations, including Carrboro Town Hall. We have the forms out front that you can pick up and mail in. They must be postmarked by October 13th, a week from this Friday, in order for you to vote this November. With that, we'll move on to our regularly printed agenda. The first item is requests from visitors and speakers from the floor. We have two people signed up to speak. First, Attorney Oren Robbins, if you would come up.
Thank
you. Right there at that microphone, please.
I would like to thank the board for the opportunity to speak. I know many of you, some of you pretty well, and you may think that I come to a lot of political meetings and speak a lot, but actually this is the first time I've ever addressed a governmental body since I protested in Washington, D.C. back during the Vietnam War. It's been a while, and while the gravity of what I'm speaking about in no way compares with the gravity of that situation some 30-odd years ago, it's something that caused me to get off my apathetic butt and come downtown to speak to you guys. And it regards a matter of a pink slip, and it's not like the pink slip that too many people receive these days. This was a pink slip, which was a notice distributed by the Carrboro Public Works Department to the doors of almost everybody in my neighborhood, specifically Spring Valley Road up North Greensboro Street. And it was a public notification that was delivered. It was dated September 29th, which was Friday of last week, advising the residents that work was going to commence, construction was going to commence the following Monday on the construction of two speed tables on our street. That was not very much notice. Effectively, it was just a weekend, and it was impossible to talk to anybody about it. And the primary point is that it was the first notice that almost all the residents on my street had received that speed tables were even being considered, much less approved. I have a request, and I will hand out copies to all the aldermen. I have previously given a copy to the clerk and to one of the people who was the people behind the move for the speed tables as a common courtesy. The request is very, very simple. It's about two sentences long. And it requests that the town, the Board of Aldermen,
ordered the Department of Public Works to cease and desist temporarily until the residents of Spring Valley Road are given an opportunity to be heard. That's not a lot to ask. In fact, I think it's the basic core essential element of a representative democratic government. The issue of speed tables arose when some concerned citizens circulated a petition. I understand they got guidance from the town public works department and the planning department. And the petition, in its essence, asked, are you concerned about speeding motor vehicles in our neighborhood? And supposedly, in excess of 75% of the people who signed the petition said that they were. The basic flawed premise in this is that signing a petition saying that you're concerned about speeding is not equivalent to an endorsement of a governmental body approving a particular plan. In the petition, it said that someone would be appointed as our representative. But the important thing about the petition is it limited the petition to being signed by one person in each household. That is a clear violation of equal protection under the law. Not all households have one person. Some have two, some have more. Every person in that household is entitled to a vote on this. It could be a husband disagrees with a wife. A partner disagrees with a wife. There may be a rental situation. What it does is the first person approached by the person circulating the petition gets the sole authority to vote for the house. It denies the other people the right. Those other people also vote. They pay taxes, property taxes. They own motor vehicles. They drive on the street. Their voice should be heard. Not only is it in violation of equal protection, or at least the principles of it, it's probably in violation of North Carolina election law, because what you're doing is you're establishing a process that creates a quasi-election. But an election that nobody knows about. The election is over and done with, and some people never even know it ever occurred. And so some individual citizen, not a government official, not a truly elected official, is named as a representative for a neighborhood. In our case, a gentleman, I believe it's a gentleman, I've never met him, on Morningside Drive, was named as our representative. And once that was done, we heard nothing more from our representative at all. We never were advised that the town was considering speed tables or any other measures. We were never advised of the cost, the timetable. We were never invited to discuss the matter, to hear the explanations, the pros and cons. My petition is not against the speed tables. My petition is just to be heard. Notice is not a difficult matter. In the law, which I do a little bit of, and this request is certainly not my best work, but it's certainly my quickest work, because it can take any form. David Poitras with the street department had no problem giving everybody notice. He just had someone stick it in our door, and boom, we had notice. Whenever the town decides there's a request for a change of zoning, what do? We put a sign up on the affected area notifying the public and, in effect, inviting comment. All kinds of legal notices are published in the paper. In this case, the residents of my street were never given any notice that you were even considering it, that you were having a meeting on it, and didn't even know you approved it. Last night, I conducted a survey. And while I have a little bit of training in surveys from long ago, I've probably forgotten all of it, but I went door to door to every door on my street. And that's because the meeting was tonight. I had one day to do it. I went and I talked to 18 residents. And of the 18 residents, 10 had signed the petition saying they were concerned. That is 55.6%, which is considerably less than the threshold 75 imposed by the procedures here. Of the 18, only 4 four, which is 22.2%, knew that the town was even considering the installing or constructing speed tables on Spring Valley Road. Eight of the 18, that was only four prior to the distribution of the pink notice, which gave, so once the pink notice was distributed, even only eight of the people looked at that and knew that it had been approved and the construction was had been started or was starting that day. That's 44%. And of that eight, not a single one of them knew that speed tables had been approved prior to the distribution of the pink slip. No one knew it. If not for Mr. Porthrit's work, the construction would start and no one would ever know what was even going on. Importantly, the sixth question on the survey, and I'll admit it's not scientific, but it was as scientific as I could do under the circumstances, is that 17 of the 18 respondents to the survey said, and I'll read the question, hopefully. Number six, would you like to have had been afforded the opportunity for a public hearing or some similar venue in which your views and input could have been considered and the proposal explained before its approval by the Board of Aldermen? 17 of 18 respondents said, yes, they would. They would have liked that. That's 94.4%. I know of no more compelling argument. The residents of an adjoining road, Blue Ridge Road, somehow got wind that speed tables were being considered, and they, as I understand it, of course we've not been provided with any of this, is that they overwhelmingly said they didn't want them, and that the town has proposed a meeting with them. I would contend that the residents of Spring Valley are entitled to the same, and we're entitled to it up front. And so what I'm asking is, it's basically the equivalent of a legal stay, just to hold off, give us a chance for a hearing, talk about the pros and cons. Nothing in my request is saying I'm for or against it. Nothing of the 17 people who answered said they were for or against it. We'd just like the chance to be heard. As you may know, they've actually started construction. They haven't reached Spring Valley Road. And that's what we ask. Time is of the essence, and I would respectfully just ask you to consider that and hopefully approve it so that the citizens can be heard. That's all we're asking. Thank you.
We have one more
questions, or
well, we have one more speaker signed up on this topic. So the board's welcome to ask Mr. Robinson questions now, or we can hear from.
I just kind of wanted to hear from Dale when the time is appropriate, just to sort of.
Well, let's go
find out what he's heard about this.
Let me go ahead and recognize Terry Krause, if Terry would like to come up and speak.
I'll keep this brief. I didn't write any. I'm Terry Krause. I live at 201 Morningside Drive in clear view of the intersection of Spring Valley Road and Morningside Drive. I've lived there for 3.5 years now and have, during the entire time, been appalled by the traffic violations that I see every day looking out of my home office and just observing the driving, including speeding down Morningside Drive, running stop signs, etc. And that's what prompted this activity when I got in touch with Dale McKeel over a year ago, and said, what can be done? And we went through the town, the very carefully and detailed process of doing traffic studies, which were done using traffic measuring devices that the town has. Dale went through all the procedures, explained them, documented them. I have a complete file on the issue. The traffic studies revealed that we had a significant speeding problem, particularly on Spring Valley Road. And anyone who takes a walk on that road on any time of day would have no choice but to confirm that personally. We have quite a few young families that have moved into our neighborhood who are pushing babies in strollers on our roads. And all of them have I've spoken with when I've met them and certainly are concerned with the speed at which people go. And Dale has some statistics on the measurements. There's no use for me to, he has a much better handle on that type of thing. But as a result of the measurements they did, it was quite clear that something needed to be done. The next step then was to take a petition, a simple petition around to a member of each household. And I will say that the area that myself and Susanna Hewson, my neighbor across the street, who lives adjacent to this intersection, it included 62 residences on Spring Valley Road and Morningside Drive and a couple of the little spur like Calumet and Abingdon Court, I think, something like that. We collected 55 signatures out of the 62 residences. Not one person we spoke to refused to sign this petition, which simply says all people who are, these are people who live adjacent to Morningside Drive, adjacent to Spring Valley Road, or adjacent to Calumet Court. We agree to the following problem. We have high-speed driving regularly on these two roads. Motorists often run the stop sign at Spring Valley and Morningside, and that motorists often make high-speed turns coming back through the other direction. At that time, there were no stop signs going the other direction. And they, out of 62 people, 62 residences, the only ones that didn't sign were the ones who were not home. Not one refused to sign. That is an 88.7% response. So I'll leave it at that. I will tell you that there is very significant documented history from the police department. Chief Hutchison had her administrative assistant prepare a history of the citations and warnings that have been issued over the past several months. I think that Dale has that information, and you would find it to be rather illuminating. One person received a ticket for going 55 miles an hour on Spring Valley Road in a 25-mile-an-hour zone, where young couples are pushing babies in strollers. Now, this has led me to be concerned enough to spend a great deal of my personal time pursuing this and following all the proper procedures with the town and having a lot of conversations with neighbors. I'm more interested, frankly, in the aspect of having a safe neighborhood to live in, a safe place to raise children, than to get very deeply into the Declaration of Independence. So I will leave it at that, and I certainly respect your concerns, fellow neighbor, but I will tell you that as far as I'm concerned, the safety of our neighbors is much more important than whether everybody's opinion is heard in this case, because, as you said, time is of the essence. The statistics, particularly from the many, many stops that the police department has made, blatantly violating traffic law in our neighborhood, point out that time is indeed of the essence. Someone is going to be hurt or killed in our neighborhood if we continue to let this go on.
Thank you, Mr. Cross.
You're very well. Thank you.
Certainly, whoever was driving 55 needs to get Warren's business card. okay. I think the suggestion was, is Dale McKeel here by any chance?
Good evening.
Good evening. Just a little background on this matter. This was an item that was on your June 6, 2006 agenda, and there was approval given for the for two-speed tables on Morningside Drive and Spring Valley Road.
Sorry, it was on our agenda
June 6th.
June 6th.
Of this year.
Okay.
And I just would just point out that, that we did follow the process that, that was approved in June of 2005 for the traffic calming procedures. And while there were some, I would say that the town has had traffic calming procedures in place for about 10 years, and we did make some changes to the process, primarily to the criteria that are used, but the particular aspect about notification really had, was not changed last year, and it's been consistent since the policy was first adopted in, I think, around 1995 or 96. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
You said we met on this topic on July 6th.
June 6th.
Right, we didn't meet July 6th. June 6th, and that would have been one of our regular business meetings as opposed to a public hearing night.
That's correct.
And I guess our current, presumably, based on this conversation, our current procedures don't call for the town or anybody else to mail out notices to owners, property owners or residents on those streets. I would throw it out there that, you know, regardless of how we deal with this particular situation that's arisen right here in Spring Valley, that we need to revise those procedures to give some official notice about when exactly
So we'll put that on the upcoming agenda.
That's what I'm suggesting. Mm-hmm.
I have a question for Dale. In your email that we received earlier today, you had made reference to the location of the speed bump. I guess there's two on Spring Valley and the parameters within which the site. Maybe not everyone got to read that, so maybe you could kind of lay that out.
I think I've got a little map that might make it easier to discuss that. This is a... This is the Spring Valley Road, and there are two speed tables. This is Spring Valley. The two speed tables are where these red dots are. David Porthes and I met with Mr. Robbins yesterday, and we discussed a couple of things. One had to do with the advanced signs that are placed before you get to the speed tables. And I believe Mr. Robbins had a concern about those being placed in the middle of his yard or one of his neighbor's yards. And David Porthes just explained there was some flexibility as far as where the signs are placed, and they would try to place those near a property line rather than putting them sort of right in the middle of somebody's front yard. The other thing we discussed was whether or not this table could be moved back a little bit further away from this location. And the concern that I have with sliding it back is the recommended distance between the intersection and the hump, the sort of the maximum that you want to shoot for is about 600 feet. And this is right at 600 feet between this intersection and that first speed bump or speed table. I'd be concerned if we slid it back even to this position that we might have some speeding concerns in this stretch and would have a request to come back and put in another traffic calming device there. So there are a lot of criteria you have to look at when you're placing the tables. There's sort of some drainage structures, and then you have to look at all the driveways and the locations of utilities under the road. So this was sort of the best location that we could find in that particular part of the street. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dale, I'm wondering if, and I'm just throwing this out because I know that stretch really well. I mean, I run it quite a bit. And right where that the red dot is actually the beginning of where the hill really starts to crest, which causes people to slow down anyway. And I'm just wondering if it were pulled back below the 600 feet, it could act as more of a calming than maybe actually where it is, because that's right at, I mean, I know that cul-de-sac, and I know that that's right at the beginning of where the hill starts to really ascend. So is there a problem with pulling it back below the 600 feet?
You're suggesting moving it back in this direction?
Uh-huh.
No, because that was where we were sort of having a problem locating it. Down in this area, there are some stormwater drains,
uh-huh,
and curb inlets, and so we couldn't put it there. And then these driveways are so close together that the speed tables are about 22 feet, and you really don't want them encroaching on someone's driveway, and you need to leave a few feet on either side. So, you know, probably the next logical place would be perhaps in this location here, and then you would have more than 600 feet, you know, between here and that next one down there. So these are some of the things we were looking at in the field when we selected these locations. And we also had the town engineer had to come out and look at these locations to make sure we wouldn't have any stormwater problems in a, mm-hmm, in a heavy rain. This particular neighborhood has valley curbs rather than standard curbs, so we had to be more careful about the location. And in fact, the work that's being done out on, mm-hmm, on Morningside Drive is to put in a standard curb just for a couple dozen feet in order to ensure there aren't going to be some stormwater problems in a heavy rain.
I remember sitting through a meeting some years ago, a very long meeting, at which we were shown about 952 different kinds of traffic calming devices. So I know that there are an awful lot out there. Could it be that we could use an alternative to a speed table? I know there are, like, rumble strips, and there are just a simple change in the pavement sometimes, like changing to brick or something. And then, I mean, is there an alternative to the speed table that wouldn't be as intrusive, that we could move a little bit closer to the three-way stop? Is that possible?
There certainly are other alternative traffic calming devices. With some of the specific devices that you mentioned that are more of a rumble strip type device, we have had some situations many years ago where something like that was installed in Carborough, and there were some concerns about noise from the, you know,
okay.
I'm not trying to discount
the
suggestion, but
no.
But that's, you know, with that particular design, that's one thing that we do have to be concerned with. But our policy does allow for a wide variety of traffic calming devices. The policy also says that we will strive to use the least expensive devices when those will work.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the speed tables are probably the much more cost-effective than some of the other devices that are available.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, in that the discussion really, or the objection that I've heard, wasn't about any particular devices. It was a process issue. And I think as Dale and Mr. Krause have explained, the process that we have in place was followed quite closely, and all the thresholds were exceeded. I think Orrin, as Mark pointed out, makes a point about some enhancements that we could perhaps make to the process and notification. Frankly, I think this is far enough along, and I think Mr. Krause has explained clearly why the work needs to be done. We've already made the decision.
Alex,
so
it was never my intention to argue the merits of this tonight.
That's what I'm saying, Orrin.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And my point being that I would recommend that we just leave this alone, but as Mark suggested, perhaps go back and make some adjustments to the notification part of the process moving forward.
If you reach the conclusion that the process is flawed, then why not correct it flawed if it be corrected before?
I guess what I'm suggesting, Orrin, is that the process has been satisfactory so far. However, you know, I understand the concerns that you've raised, every process can always be enhanced, as you know. So
I would not be willing to stipulate that your actual process has been followed. That requires a threshold of 75%. My survey indicated it was. Initially in discussion about the different options and stuff would be something I'm sure the neighborhood would like to participate in. Where the downside of giving 2-3 weeks for neighborhood participation is minimal. And while sure someone could be hurt the next day, the fact is there's never been a reported accident due to excessive speed on that street. And if you want to talk merits, the survey showed that 85% of the people were driving 34 miles an hour or less. And what I'm just saying is give the opportunity for the hearing so the people of the street can participate in discussion like we almost went into.
I'm afraid that I'm persuaded that the procedures we have right now are constitutionally adequate, but that they can be improved, as Alex said, and that we should take that up soon. I let me suggest for right now that if the town attorney is available shortly, that I would be glad to meet with Mr. Robbins and the town attorney to review whether there is any whether we have in any, because I don't want to discuss it right now. I don't think this is the right forum for discussion of it, but whether there is any evidence that we, any indication that we didn't follow the process that we had set out. Because if there is an indication that we didn't follow our own process, then that, I think, is a considerable issue, and we need to go back and follow the process that we have if we haven't done so. So I'd be willing to meet and discuss that issue with Mr. Robbins tomorrow or as soon as we can get a meeting scheduled. But I'm inclined to leave this situation the way it is for right now.
That's fine with me.
Is that an acceptable way to proceed as far as the board's concerned?
Sure.
All right, well, we'll make an effort to, whether with the town attorney or some other staff, and I will attempt to set up a meeting to review that particular question, and we will put it on our work schedule for some time later this year or in any case certainly before the next time that we are consider another traffic calming measure. We will, before we get to the next traffic calming project, have an opportunity to review what our procedures are and make some updates to it. All right. With that, we're on to our consent agenda. Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item 1 is approval of minutes of the previous meeting of September 19th, 2006. Item 2 is a request to cancel the November 7th meeting. Item 3 is a resolution urging the North Carolina General Assembly to enact legislation to increase conservation spending. Item 4 is a request to adopt an ordinance amending Chapter 3 of the Town Code. Item 5 is a request to approve a budget amendment. Item 6 is a request to set a public hearing on a conditional use permit request for 211 Lloyd Street, and that public hearing would be October 24th, 2006. Item 7 is an appointment to the Human Services Commission. Item 8 is a resolution requesting waiver of street assessment payment acceleration, and item 9 is a request to adopt a budget amendment.
The items.
Second.
The entire consent agenda has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. We are on to agenda item D1, a presentation on the status report on the county master aging plan.
Okay. Purpose of this item is for members of the Master Aging Plan Steering Committee to present a status report to the board on its plan and to give the mayor and board an opportunity to make comments on the plan. On November 14th, the final report will be submitted to the County Board of Commissioners for approval. I believe you all have a presentation.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Pat Sprigg. I'm the co-chair of the Master Aging Plan. Florence Soltes is co-chair as well, and if I can figure out this math. You know, the worst thing you can do is give me a microphone, my slideshow, And what's worse is putting me in charge of technology, not a good thing to do. I will try and make this as brief as possible. The Master Aging Plan to some of you is not new, and I want to recognize also Jerry Passmore, who's in the room, who's the project manager of this particular project. What is the Master Aging Plan's goals? It's simply to develop and implement a Master Aging Plan that provides comprehensive and coordinated delivery system of community services to older adults. Also, it's to promote, and instead of senior, I'd like for us to talk about aging-friendly community as part of a smart growth policy. And also, it is to coordinate a countywide plan that integrates the resources of many public and private community partners. One of the major flaws of the long-term care system is the fragmentation. And so what this plan endeavors to do is to pull existing resources and put together a plan that addresses the needs at hand. The mission is very simple, and it's to maintain and improve the independence, the functionality, and the quality of older residents for as long as possible, which is the rest of their life. The definition of aging and planning, we're using the 60-plus. Some people do not like the boomer terminology, so we will use the post-World War II. However, I will say that I am a boomer and proud of it. The planning, it's really a roadmap in terms of looking community countywide and putting together a strategic plan for the next 5 years. The demographic profile, okay, so I am a long-term resident of Carrboro, and in your packets you have the various demographic distribution of people over the age of 60. We have 1,150 individuals in that category, and I'd also like to thank, as you look at that particular dot chart that you have in front of you, it shows you the distribution of people of those ages. I'd like to recognize that Triangle J Council of Governments was very helpful in putting that information together for us. So long-term citizen of Carrboro, I know that we are the town of arts, and we tend to attract young people, but I will also tell you that young people over time turn into old people. And we are looking at
I've noticed that. Actually.
Have you noticed that? Yeah. Unfortunately, personally, I have noticed that. And so we are looking for developing communities that are aging friendly. And when you look at the demographics nationwide, chronologically, we're living longer. We're seeing an explosion of numbers. Do you know that in this county we have more people over the age of 65 than in the school system? That begins to tell you the handwriting on the wall in terms of what is happening demographic. We used to think in generations as sometimes two generations, and then it went into three generations. We are now seeing four generations living in the same lifetime. We're seeing people live more of their advanced years in declining health and limited function. But unfortunately, we have tended to think of aging synonymous with illness, and that's not necessarily the case. And so we want to point out in the Master Aging Plan that there is a major human resource that is growing in our county, and that is the retiree population. I'm sure that many of you realize that Chapel Hill Carrboro is a retiree destination. And we are the third largest retiree state in the nation, growth numbers. So that tells you what is ahead of us in terms of aging. As we begin to look at the Master Aging Plan, it becomes clear that you cannot put a plan simply on chronological age, but rather we have to look at functionality. And we've divided that into the three Fs, the fit, the well-fit who live at home, the frail who are disabled and moderately impaired and need services in order to remain independent, and then the fragile who are the institutionalized living in nursing homes and other alternatives. I won't go over the timeline. I will put out a couple of highlights. We kicked off this planning event in December 1st. We've completed the identification and the prioritization of the task force in March and April. On September 19th, we received the Board of County Commissioners' approval for the preliminary goals and objectives, and where we are now is eliciting feedback from town officials, United Way agencies, public, to make sure that we have hit the mark in terms of the various goals and objectives. So looking at an aging-friendly community, the steering committee is really having to modify the theme from senior-friendly, because we really believe that seniors are part all-inclusive. And I want to point out that if you are senior-friendly, you are aging-friendly. If you think of an older person having a hard time navigating curbs, think of a young mother with a stroller navigating those curbs. Or think of people who are physically challenged navigating certain walkways. So we're looking at building smart communities around the whole concept of aging friendly being the key factor, and not necessarily pulling out just the seniors. It's a coming together, a pooling of resources, an avoiding of duplication, and trying to get all of the county government and towns to be on the same page in terms of their planning. In terms of developmental facts, most cities and counties do not have this type of plan in place to meet the needs of the aging community, and so this really does put us on the map, so to speak. Also, it is clear that most older adults desire to remain in their home and to be part of the community for as long as possible. And we know that the conventional urban design characteristics present certain obstacles, again, not just to older persons, but people who are physically challenged as well, including mothers with young children. So we're looking at the development of aging-friendly communities, being good for all ages, and we're looking at being ready for the age boom that is about to hit this county. 77 million baby boomers are turning age 60 every single minute. And so in 2020, we will hit the boom of those 70-plus million people looking for aging-friendly communities. When you look at aging-friendly communities, it's one with the physical environment, the health, economy, technology, safety, security, social, cultural involvement, services, support, resources, and planning stewardship. People of all ages, in terms of looking at these characteristics as they look for towns. The dimensions in which to evaluate those components are whether or not there's an existence, an adequacy, an accessibility, efficiency, equity, and effectiveness. And so moving to the actual plan itself, you have received the preliminary goals and all of the objectives, and we divided the plan into 9 major goals. First, there are 4 overarching goals: information access, housing, shelter, transit, mobility, and community transitional care. And these goals really span all older people. And then we go into the functionality where the well-fit, disabled, moderately impaired, and institutionalized all have separate objectives that need to be addressed. And then the last two, we realized that we really needed to promote a legislative and advocacy aging agenda, so that we keep the challenges and opportunities of aging out in front as we begin to plan public policy for the future. The next part is that I started this by saying that anyone who works or tries to navigate long-term care or the systems that exist, you'll find that it's very fragmented. And so our hope is to enhance the planning, administration, coordination, and funding of a response system to the needs based on this gap analysis that we have done. So hopefully I have remained true to the time in terms of rushing through this. No one has ever said that I am a slow speaker. But tonight we really wanted to introduce the new theme of aging-friendly community. We wanted to make sure you have copies of that, the Bill of Rights statements for older persons, and also to put forth to you the preliminary goals and objectives and strategies. We have given you pink input sheets that we ask you to please fill out. If you'd like to do that very quickly, great, but more importantly, give it thought and mail it back would be great. So I will open it up for questions, if you have questions.
We'll recognize the oldest alderman first. Who is that?
Just Randy.
Sorry. How about if we recognize the youngest of us first?
And you know what, Pat? I'm proud of it. Okay. So I thought this material was wonderful. In fact, I thought the active living was so wonderful. I gave it to my 83-and-a-half-year-old mother who lives with me right here in Carborough. So, I'm really glad that this is happening because this couldn't happen at a more critical moment. The flight of senior citizens out of our area because of the lack of support systems is critical. So we're losing our vertical community, and this I'm just thank you so much, and Jerry and Francis, is it? Yeah.
Florence.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan.
Yeah, I also want to. I read through the report and I was very impressed, having gone through the process with my own parents of addressing many of these concerns. I had two suggestions. One is under the various strategy sections in the document, I didn't see anything about continuing to inform and engage us about how we can help with all this. So I didn't, I'm not suggesting where to do that, but that's something to fit in. And then I also had a suggestion on the Bill of Rights, which I thought was a very good document. But item number two says the right to an income in retirement, which would provide an adequate standard of living. And my suggestion is to strike the words in retirement from that and consider that all older persons have the right to an income which would provide an adequate standard of living.
Thank you.
Point.
Thank you.
Jackie?
If we're going in descending order, I guess I would be next.
I was kidding about the whole thing. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
And I agree with my elder at that end of the table that we need a way of making sure that this isn't another one of those wonderful reports that sits on a shelf somewhere. I'd like for us to refer the document to the Human Services Commission.
Yes.
So that they're aware of it, maybe even have the same presentation, even though they're not being asked for money. But I'm just kind of playing with this idea in my head, and it has to do with a lot of our sustainable issues. We need overlays so that, you know, in making decisions in planning or making decisions in recreation or making decisions in transportation, that there's kind of a red flag reminder to refer back to this report and see how the needs of that we're all going to have sooner or later are being incorporated into those. I mean, I'm just kind of tossing that out as an idea. I mean, we do that now with environmental issues, and we're beginning to do it with economic sustainability issues. But if we would just have these principles that are then referred to in our decision making, we can play with that later. But that may be a way of continuing the base touching.
I just want to commend you and thank you for the excellent work you folks are doing. And I think Carrboro nationally, you know, if we're going to launch a campaign, as you say, Carrboro is well known for its arts and its people. And maybe a good slogan for us would be aging gaily community, you know. We have very happy people here.
Excellent suggestion.
Move the resolution receiving the report.
Second.
All right. And I'm assuming that as a part of that, I was going to say the same thing as Jackie, that a part of that is referring that to the
suggestions.
That referring it to the Human Services Advisory Board, since at some point these funding issues play out there at some level.
And I would like us to have to put on you and Steve to get on our agenda. I would like to formally request that the discussion appear on our agenda of how to create of how to incorporate these concerns into kind of our daily municipal life. And I think that goes beyond the Human Services Advisory Board. It goes into zoning and environment and transportation.
You mean
and
the goals, not the concerns.
What I mean
incorporate these
is
goals.
The concerns okay. be touched on. So that would be
a lot of
I'd just refer that to our agenda setters.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the materials in the report also touch on issues of land use and zoning.
Yeah,
they do.
Right.
And I think,
and urban development patterns.
Just briefly, that it strikes me that Carrboro and Orange County together are way out in front of most communities by not only by looking at this issue, but also with all of the attention that's being paid right now to early childhood education as well. And I just think that represents, you know, at some level what it gets down to is we're looking at the changing demographics of our own community. And we're getting both younger and older in Carrboro. And
those are future old people. So
that's right. Hopefully. Absolutely. All right. Thanks very much. So it's been moved and seconded that we receive this report and refer it to the Human Services Advisory Board, among other things. All okay. those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. And you guys will put my idea on the agenda?
We will. Take
as,
that.
As a fellow baby boomer, Jackie, it's very important. Information.
Well, I'm just afraid we'll forget. That's why I want to make sure.
I made a note. I don't forget where the note is.
I was born after 1964, so
you
I'll try.
And you missed out on the fun.
Yes, I did.
There you go.
I don't know how to get your...
That's okay.
All right. Thanks very much. We are on to agenda item D2, a resolution regarding Chernhurst Nuclear Plant.
I bet that won't pass.
how much?
It's not this board.
How much do you want to bet? I don't think we need a staff presentation.
There is no
I believe
presentation.
Randy and or Dan asked to have this on our agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can speak to it. Are you? Go ahead.
Yeah, let me go first because. Okay.
Move your microphone closer so we can hear you.
Well. I was just going to say. In view of the fact that this is Fire Safety Week, and as a teacher who is very much involved with this in the classroom, I want to say how concerned I've been for the lack of compliance in fire safety that has been evidenced at Chernhurst. It first became evident to me back in April. I did raise some questions here on the board. I know at my school, we spend the whole month of September working on fire drills, working on fire safety, and if we didn't meet code, we couldn't open, and the children could not come to school. So, I support the resolution. I think that until the point at which Chernhurst can meet and comply with the appropriate safety codes, that they should be closed, as my school would be closed.
Let me add that, without overstating the case, that I think it's scandalous and hopefully won't be tragic that the federal government and our state government is not making a top priority of nuclear plant safety, but that doesn't mean that Carrboro cannot do so. And I think it's very, very critical for us to take this step in joining these five organizations, one of which is based in Carrboro, one of which has many, many Carrboro members and that have been active in monitoring this issue for many years. So I think this is an important step for us. I also want to take a moment to commend the Chamber of Commerce for its interest in this issue, because it is the Chapel Hill Carrboro Chamber of Commerce, and among the worst possible things that could happen for the Chapel Hill Carrboro business community would be a significant accident at the Sharon Harris plant, and that would be not just for business but for all of us a terrible eventuality. So I hope the whole community will understand the severity of this problem and raise their concern along with us on having Progress Energy be required to resolve these problems.
Yeah. We'll note that the president of the Board of Realtors is in the room. Perhaps he will take some, or he's actually the president of the Chamber of Commerce, I think, but he's a member of the Board of Realtors. Perhaps he will take note of this matter as well.
I'll move the revised item.
What's the difference between the revised item and the original?
There's two additional whereases, the second one and the fourth one.
Okay. So not a substantive change in that sense.
No. Right.
Okay.
I'll second it.
All right. It has been moved and seconded that we pass the revised resolution. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. Agenda item D3 is a review of the report on the Bowling Creek Watershed Restoration Team's Clean Water Management Trust Fund mini-grant application.
Okay. The Bowling Creek Watershed Restoration Team needs to conduct a geomorphic analysis in the watershed to identify potential locations for stormwater retrofit projects and stream restoration activities. Clean Water Management Trust Fund has a stormwater mini-grant program for which this activity is eligible. Staff would like the board to consider authorization to apply for and perform the functions and obligations of the mini-grant as set out in the grant agreement that could result from this grant application. And Will Autry. Yes.
Mr. Manager, I recall that we had a fairly detailed discussion about this general topic just a couple of weeks ago. I don't know whether if any of the board members would like to hear a full presentation on this, that'd be fine.
Yeah,
but
unless somebody else wants to hear the presentation, I will move the resolution.
I'll second.
Recommended action.
Yep.
Nice work. Well, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Sorry, aye.
I'm sorry, Will.
Would you like to do
get
the
out
next
easy
presentation? Maybe.
Thank you. Thank you for proving that. That's the important thing for us.
Right. Thank you.
This will, for those of you watching at home, this will hopefully get us some money in cooperation with other area local governments to look at opportunities for improving stormwater management in the Bowling Creek watershed, a grant from the Clean Water Management Trust Fund. Okay. Did we vote on that motion? We did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're on item D4, review and comment on the draft 2007-2013 State Transportation Improvement Program.
Well, the purpose of this item is for the board to review and comment on the draft Transportation Improvement Program. Two resolutions have been prepared for the board's consideration, and Dale McKeel, our transportation planner, does have a brief presentation on the status of the plan and an update on some of the projects that fail.
Good evening again. I will try to be brief. This as mentioned in the report, the state is moving the TIP from the even numbered years to odd numbered years. And so there was a draft TIP put out just a little over a year ago, and if it seems like it hasn't been very long ago, that's because it hasn't been. But they are moving to the odd numbered years, and so that's why we're going through the process again. briefly, the steps in adopting the TIP. First, Carrboro adopts a local priority list. The MPO takes the list from Carrboro and the other municipalities and counties in our MPO and puts together a regional priority list and shares that with NCDOT. NCDOT adopts a draft TIP, and then both the state and the MPO receive comments on the draft TIP. That's sort of where we are at this point. In the next couple months, the MPO will adopt a draft TIP. The MPO and the NCDOT will get together to try to reconcile the differences between the state and the regional documents, and then the final TIP is adopted by both the MPO and the Board of State Board of Transportation. There are several enhancement projects in the draft TIP. Most of these you have seen before. I did want to point out the one, the Roberson Place bike path is virtually completed, so it will not most likely not appear in the final document. And then also the Sewell School Road bike lanes is a $650,000 project. It was in the last TIP, but I just wanted to flag that because we may want to talk about it again in a couple minutes. There are other projects that are in the draft TIP. This is another project, the real-time information system, which is currently being implemented. There have been some articles in the newspaper about this recently. It likely would not show up in the final TIP either. This is the most significant new project in the TIP. This is a there's not a lot of new money at the state level. You probably have seen some articles about that as well. And so this TIP, most of a lot of projects are actually being moved back, and but for our for Carrboro, the signal system is actually operated. Signals in Carrboro are operated by the town of Chapel Hill under an agreement. The town of Chapel Hill has for several years felt there's a need to upgrade the system to have a fiber optic system in replacing the old copper system that was installed in the early to mid 90s. And there is funding for this for the first time. It's the funding is for the year 2011. I think Chapel Hill's not real happy with that with the timing of that, and they may take some steps to try to move that up. And there was a document in your packet sort of explaining the more detail on the need for this system, some of the benefits that it would provide. We want to highlight three projects in Carrboro: Estes Drive, Smith Level Road, and Old Fayetteville Road. Estes Drive has been the town's highest priority project for a number of years. Unfortunately, in this draft TIP, there's still no funding for it. I also would point out that and on the MPO, the regional list, it's the number four project in Orange County, and yet it still has not received any funding. We also suggested that the project be constructed in two phases, hoping that that might move it up in the funding process, and to no avail. Because of the lack of funding for that project, we have had some, and as you know, there's been a lot of public discussion about the bike lanes on Estes Drive, particularly since there were some widened shoulders on a section of Estes Drive between Sewell School Road and NC86. And we have spoken with NCDOT about trying to find some funding for bike lanes on Estes Drive between Hillcrest and the town limits. And this is an area where there appears to be adequate right-of-way to put in both bike lanes and a sidewalk. There's a sidewalk plan there, as you know, with the as part of the Bond sidewalk projects. And so any bike lanes that were built there would need to be coordinated with the sidewalk. Our contact with the state DOT have said that it would really help move things along if there were a resolution of support for this funding from the Board of Aldermen. Maybe move over a step. This is a section of Estes Drive that's in the town of Carrboro, and this sort of shows the area where the right-of-way is. It's 100 feet in this area based on the best data that we have, and then it narrows down to 80 feet in this area, and then once you get down closer to Greensboro, it's much narrower. I think it's probably about 35 feet or so in that area. The suggestion was to request for the funding for bike lanes, at least from Hillcrest Street up to the town limits, and also, of course, in the Chapel Hill side over to Sewell School Road. In order to provide a link to North Greensboro Street from Estes Drive, a suggestion has been made to also create an off-road path that would extend from the end of Williams Street through Wilson Park and through the Adams Track along a sewer easement over to Estes Drive. And you may recall when you all reviewed the Adams Track Management Plan back, I believe that was in May or June, there was also some discussion about this. I don't think it was a formal part of that management plan, but it was referenced in that plan. Let me go back now. So the resolution that's in your packet doesn't specifically mention funding for this request. I did mention it was on town-owned property. We haven't done a feasibility study of that, of a trail in that location. We don't have any idea what the cost might be, but if this is something that the board is interested in pursuing, we could apply for DOT or MPO funding. Another possibility would be to request some of those funds from the Sewell School Road project that I mentioned earlier, which is a project to put bike lanes on Sewell School Road. If it was felt this was a higher priority project, we could request funding be transferred from Sewell School Road to this project.
The Adams Track, as we all know, is a very sensitive piece of property. It's also one that was very hard to acquire, and it's beautiful and needs to be preserved. I am not necessarily against, although I don't know yet where I stand, but I'm not necessarily against a multimodal path going there. However, I know that once we get into looking at DOT standards for something that goes through the woods, environmental protection is not always foremost in their mind. And I would be a little scared that in order to get DOT money, we'd really have to pay for it, and maybe at the expense of the integrity of the Adams Track.
Well, I think it's important to know. I actually rode that on my bicycle the other day. That's the one part of the Adams Track that our conservation easements do not prevent bicycling on.
Right.
And I guess the key point about it is there's already, I think it's about a 40-foot wide swath that Everett Billingsley gave us right through there for the sewer line. So, I think the key point would be that if it's entirely within the existing cleared area that OWASA maintains as cleared, then it doesn't have that great of an impact on.
I also think that, I understand your concern. However, for a bike and ped facility of this kind, which would be town-owned, it would not be owned by NCDOT. We're talking about trying to troll up some money from STPDA or bike and ped. We would build it. We would design and build it to the town's specifications. So basically, we could do it how we wouldn't be constrained to an NCDOT cross section, right, Dale?
Well, if there's federal funding, we would have to meet some of their design guidelines.
My concerns stand, and I know this isn't something we're doing immediately, but my concerns stand.
Oh, sure.
Point of clarification, does the Francis Shetley Bikeway meet DOT standards? Was it designed to do that?
I believe it does, yes. It was also funded with the same STPDA funds that Alex was referencing.
And given the new kinds of material that are more permeable than the asphalt that the Francis Shetley Bikeway has, is there the possibility that another surface would be used?
That's certainly something that could be looked at. I don't know if I can answer your question.
Having visited it recently, I think the existing surface is totally impermeable. I mean, Owosso drives its trucks through there periodically and backhoes and things like that. Yeah. There's a certain amount of gravel there already. And so I'm not trying to, and I don't think Alex was either, trying to dismiss the concern, but just to point out that this was at some level contemplated in crafting the management plan for the
Adams
Tract. It's
DOT's money that...
So that's where things get started. You get them mixed up in it. Well, and I think we should keep a careful eye on it. The point is a good one.
I would add that I completely sympathize with the concern, and obviously we need to keep an eye on it. But we're dealing with a problem that has been insoluble for years, which, of course, are ped and bike access on Estes and through that corridor. And, frankly, in the short term, it's not a solvable problem otherwise. This may be a solution to that problem, which we may be able to achieve in the reasonably near term. Just to give folks a little bit of history, if you don't remember, some years ago, Estes Drive, the improvements were actually funded. And through shenanigans that nobody understands over the objections of the MPO, the funding was shifted to another project in Orange County, which will remain nameless. But
how diplomatic.
Yeah. It's old news, and after lengthy discussion and negotiation, it was clear that NCDOT's position in that was not going to change.
Right.
So we've got to just work around it. And
can we go back to the map? I realize you're sort of still in the middle of your presentation here on a couple other points, but sticking on Estes Drive for just a minute. So if this multi-use path were built, then the critical bicycling safety needs would be basically from just past Treetop Condominiums, which is that little condominium right there.
Yeah. Near the entrance of
Estes Park. From the Estes Park entrance along over to basically, well, getting as far as Olmsted Drive would be a huge breakthrough. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously it would be desirable to get all the way to Sewell School Road, but just from there to Olmsted Drive would get you to a place where you can get onto a safer street to ride a bicycle.
You could live longer.
and from there quickly connect you in with the Chapel Hill Greenway system. Would it make sense for us to really focus our request to DOT with regard to the Estes Drive improvements and say, look, you know, all right, we know you don't want to pay for all of this, but here is really what we need. Is we need improvement from Estes Park Apartments to Olmsted Drive, which actually is beyond our town limits. But
right, and if we want to troll up some STPDA funding, now's the time to do it, because this is where we're constructing the allocations for the next funding cycle.
I think what you're suggesting would be fine. The reason I had suggested asking to go all the way to Hillcrest is just because of the sidewalk issue. And, you know, if
well, I'm not opposed to trying, I mean, to coordinate, you know, we want it the whole way. I mean, clearly, but
right.
But you know, I would look to y'all's guidance on you and Alex's guidance. You two have a lot more experience than the rest of us with it. But
I just agree with Dale. Let's start with as much as we, you know, we think we can logically try for, and if in the process of negotiation.
Well, let's put that. Let me reframe that as simply saying, you know, if we can get the funding for the multi-use path, but what we have to do is compromise and take a little bit less of improvements on Estes Drive extension.
Right.
It's dangerous.
Yeah, they have to work together. You can't. I mean, the improvements along Estes up to Hillcrest aren't going to do us much good without a multi-use path as the primary.
It would do some good
for the bike and but everybody still gets in a crunch up where the right of way narrows to 35 feet. Which
it's the uphill and the turn as you come into
Carborough. It's all dangerous. but that's where it gets really ugly. And so if we were to do both components in some form or fashion, then we actually create a seamless bike and ped corridor, which will siphon the bike and ped traffic off.
Now, let me ask one slightly different question, and then we'll go to Dan. Sorry. But the way this was done between Sewell School Road and MLK on Essie's Drive extension,
that was moving ahead.
But it was a widened shoulder.
Right.
It was billed as a widened shoulder as a way of getting away from the debate over whether to build a bike lane, basically, I guess.
Yeah, and that's what made it eligible for moving ahead funds, because that's what moving ahead funds did, was widening with widened shoulders. The thing that made it easy is you didn't get into that whole discussion about right-of-ways, which we've gone round and round
right.
and round.
Familiar discussion. Well, yeah. I just throw that out there as another, you know, interim possibility would be whether we could get some widened shoulder, again, particularly where the right-of-way is wide.
Right. Or we could just call it that as opposed to bike lanes. Although there's no moving ahead money left, is there, Dale?
Not much.
Well, regardless, yeah. I guess the point is that you know, any paved space at all for a bicycle...
No, it can't hurt to broaden your definitions.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Would be a dramatic improvement. Yeah. And it's certainly, I think we all know, this is certainly, you know, this is not only our top priority for... as this board, but it's something we hear from the citizens about all the time. All the time.
All right. So my question is, the funding sources we're talking about for this, does the project for the multi-use path, does it need to be on the priority list to qualify for those sources?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Can't hurt to put it there, though, okay. because the idea is to broaden the net as much as possible, because we control around... for STPDA money, which we actually control. We can all who's running bike and ped now since David retired?
Tom Norman is
Tom,
the director
that's right.
of the
right. And so look to Tom and his shop, just start poking around, see who's and obviously go to Doug and see what Doug can do for us. So the answer is yeah, can't hurt.
Okay. So do we need to do that tonight? Is this kind of is this coming to us again before it's done? Or
it comes up all the time.
The local priority list that was adopted in March of 2005 is Attachment C.
Yeah.
Is
that we could probably just modify Estes Drive and just add the multi-use path as a component to that. What do you think, Dale? Better do that or do it separate?
I think you...
That would
be fine.
That works.
They really, as you point out, they really do go together. I mean,
yeah. So why don't we just add whatever? Dan, is this kind of what you were getting
at? Mm-hmm.
So just add the description of the multi-use path to the language under number one.
Attachment C.
Yeah.
But I guess, Jackie, did you want to talk about the multi-use path more? I mean, did you have concerns about the path itself, or just
concerns
farther
down? Well, we would have an opportunity.
Okay.
Right, review that
have an
before
opportunity.
It's built, correct?
Yeah, all we're doing at this point is trolling around for bucks, and then we can...
Yeah, and I would want us to be very careful that we examined the strings that were attached to any bucks that we accepted. I would want us to...
Understood.
...to commit to that.
Sure.
I have one more question related to this topic, which is... You know, ultimately, well, not ultimately, but penultimately, our goal is to get these, whatever, bicycle and pedestrian improvements to reach to Umstead Drive, as a first step. That's obviously, you know, we always talk about this in terms of to the town line, but nobody's trying to get to the town line. Is Chapel Hill placed this anywhere in their priority list, or
the same discussion is taking place between Chapel Hill and DOT about getting some additional funding to complete it from the town line up to Sewell School Road?
And have they already had the equivalent of this discussion or hearing at the?
I don't know. They have not.
Right,
okay,
yeah.
So maybe
probably want to give Ed and Kevin a heads up.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay. Well, Alex, you and I will, I'm sure,
yeah,
make some contacts over there. All right. Sorry. Now, you were saying, Dale.
Saying.
All right. The second project that I wanted to highlight is Smith Level Road. And the compared to the 2006-2012 TIP, the right-of-way acquisition has been moved back from 2007 to 2010. Construction has been moved back from 2010 to 2012. The resolution that's in your packet requests that right-of-way stay in 2007 and construction in 2010 in order that the bike lanes and sidewalks would be available to connect to Carrboro High School. There also was in your packet a request that the town manager sent to the state DOT in August, just asking their assistance in moving the project forward. There still is not resolution to the whole cross-section issue, and I did speak with someone over there last week, and they are working on that. They said they're reviewing it. They're talking with Doug Gallion, our Board of Transportation member, about that, and do hope to be able to provide a response to that.
Aren't going
to
budge
to that letter.
That's the question.
Sometime very soon. And the third project I wanted to mention was Old Fayetteville Road. Let me go to a map on this one also. That there was a project. There was one project called U3100, which was to put bike lanes and sidewalks along along Hillsborough Road, as well as Old Fayetteville, back down to 54. When McDougal School was built, this portion of the project was expedited, and of course that was completed just a couple of years ago. So the only section that has not been, where bike lanes and sidewalks have not been added, is just from the school property down to 54. And so this is the remaining piece of that, of this project. In order to expedite that project, NCDOT has proposed classifying it as a bicycle and pedestrian project rather than a highway project. It simplifies their process somewhat to do that. And our recommendation is that we would not object to that classification change, just so it doesn't have a negative impact on the ability to fund the project, and that the highway fund would remain as a source of funding as it's shown in the draft TIP. This project is shown in the TIP, the right-of-way being funded in the year 2012, and the construction taking place sometime after that. It's not, the year is not specified because it's outside of the TIP. So one additional recommendation that's in the resolution is just to revise all the project descriptions to include that we want bike lanes, sidewalks, and transit accommodations on all the highway projects that are in the TIP. This has been a request we've made for several years now, and for some reason the descriptions are not changed, but we did want to go ahead and continue to make that request. And there's a copy of the priority list that was adopted back in 2005.
Okay. I think I heard Alex almost articulate a motion earlier.
Yeah, except I'm going to have to do something squirrely. I will move the 2007-2013 TIP local priority list, as we've discussed, with the additions discussed. However, I need to ask that be all items except number 3, same for the resolution, all items except number 3, and I have to ask to be recused from commenting on item number 3, as I own property on Sewell School Road.
Okay. Okay, so that's with the addition of the description of the possible multi-use path. Is there a second for that? And we'll vote separately on priority on item number 3 for priority list.
Yeah, it's both in the resolution. It's conveniently both item number 3 in the resolution and the priority list. So the motion contains both of those.
Okay, and then we'll do a second.
Number 3 redacted from each.
And did you say the change language on the Estes Drive?
Yes.
Right. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. Is there a motion for item three in the resolution and in the priority list? Although it's been moved and seconded, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? I assume that by acclamation we agreed to excuse Alderman Zaffron from voting on that.
I guess I've been excused since I just sat here like a lump on a log.
It was implicit in the situation. Yeah. The chair has the authority to call what the vote was. 5-0 was
works
the vote
for me
on the second item. A break is urgently desired. Yeah. For a quick question for Dale before the break.
And the board. I mean, this stuff is really important to us here in Carrboro, and as we continue to improve the quality of life of everyone. And DOT, as we know, and Alex is the expert on dealing with that creature. It would be very helpful for us to hear from you. How can we? I think our delegation, you know, every time we meet with the delegation, we ask them for priority items, and you know, with money we can do many things. And it seems like we just do piecemeal approach, you know, a little bit here, a sidewalk here. I mean, we just bend over backwards just to get sidewalks and bike lanes and. I would love for us to think about a specific request. I don't know if you're in the way of a bill, or you know, we got some really strong representatives in the General Assembly that we need to request to make this a priority, so that we get the funding that we need and accelerate some of these projects that are. Truly not only enhancing the quality of life, but at public safety issues for the town of Carrboro.
I would say that at the General Assembly level, there's not much of a tradition of requesting funding for transportation projects through the appropriations process at the General Assembly, funding specific projects. At the national level, though, it is with the all the discussion about earmarks and bridges to nowhere and so forth, there is more of a tradition of making those requests, so that also would be worth consideration. So
it's worth noting that on the federal level, a lot of our juice, if you will, is likely to be taken up by earmark requests for transit improvements for the system-wide. So
yeah, that's true.
We're asking David to work on that.
But I think we have at times had members of our local delegation help in some of our discussions with DOT, and that aspect of your suggestion is a good one.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Thanks. Have a question about whether both resolutions were adopted.
Oh, no, that's right.
This is there a second resolution?
Resolution B.
The resolution on the...
Oh, sorry.
What's resolution B?
That's the one on the Estes Drive. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
A separate resolution on Estes Drive.
Yeah, move resolution B.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed.
Oh, and it should be understood that was with the additional language describing
the multi-use path.
The multi-use path added where appropriate.
I took that as implicit in the motion.
No.
All those in, so it's been moved, and the vote was 6-0. Matter passed unanimously. We're going to take a 5-minute break. Planning Board recommendation for a development moratorium in the Northern Study Area.
The Planning Board has developed a proposal for a moratorium on rezonings, major subdivisions, and special and conditional use permit applications in Carrboro's Northern Study Area, and has distributed the proposal to other advisory boards for comments. A development moratorium as a temporary suspension of the land use ordinance provisions is enacted using the text amendment process, meaning that a draft ordinance must be prepared and a public hearing date set. A resolution that provides an opportunity to respond to the Planning Board request has been prepared for the Board's use, and Trish McGuire, Planning Administrator, is at the podium to give you all a presentation as to the Planning Board's recommendation. Trish.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. So this is a following up a recommendation that the Planning Board made in May and distributed to other advisory boards for review. It was sent to the Board of Aldermen in memo form in June, and at that time you requested a discussion to be scheduled for the fall on this topic. As was briefly mentioned in the purpose statement, the process associated with development moratoria is that they are temporary suspensions of the land use ordinance or land use regulations, and as such, As such, they're enacted using the text amendment process, so the draft ordinance is prepared and a public hearing held. There were some changes made to the general statutes in 2005 that we have had a couple of development moratoria in the past 9 years or so, and the provisions under that we operate under, the authority given to municipalities to enact these actions has changed somewhat as a result of those provisions. They affect the way that they're defined and the how many projects they, the type of projects they can apply to. So just to kind of summarize in terms of the Northern Study Area, the area of focus that the Planning Board has described in their recommendation is all of the Northern Study Area as it was defined for the purposes of the facilitated small area plan for Carrboro's Northern Study Area. It starts down here at Estes Drive, goes up along North Greensboro and then Hillsboro to Old 86. It encompasses all of the area along Union Grove Church Road and then back along the ridgeline, carries back to, Union Grove Church Road back to Old 86 here at the north, runs down along the boundary of the Duke Forest properties, then comes down Rogers Road, and then cuts back through to Sewell School Road. And so it is about 3,700 acres of land, almost half of the town's planning jurisdiction in its entirety. It did then and does include still different types of jurisdiction, and that the city limits are included here, as well as property that's in our extraterritorial jurisdiction and within the joint planning transition areas. And so, of course, there are slightly different things that we can do, could do, and can do in those areas. And the plan was, this area was selected for that planning process, though, because it was envisioned as the area into which new development would grow. There was one moratorium two moratoria established in over this area before, during the period of time when the draft ordinances that implemented the Northern Study Area Plan were being developed. And so between the fall of 1997 and the winter of 1998, the area was under development moratorium. As I mentioned, there are some changes in terms of how a moratorium could be applied to projects, and there are limitations on its applicability to projects that have a vested right, that already have permits. I haven't mentioned any of those in the report or in this slide, but it also can't apply to projects that are actively in the conditional use or special use permit process, and so projects that where we've received applications and are processing those. And there are three currently that are being processed within the Northern Study Area. They are the Ballantyne Subdivision, the elementary school up off Eubanks Road, and Carrboro Greens. There are a number of projects that fall into a slightly different...
What is the Ballantyne? Remind us where the Ballantyne Subdivision is.
Ballantyne is the project just north of the Jones property off Old 86. It was also called before the Village is at Berkeley. Thanks. And it's the project that MI Homes has been working on an application for
it's
a
couple between,
of years.
It's between Lake Hogan Farms and the county park. Mm-hmm.
It is, and right. The Jones property comes in a little bit, so it is just south of the
right.
Twin Creeks
okay.
Park. Yep. So then we have a number of projects that are under discussion. Staff has been contacted about projects or preliminary review, including Claremont 2, the Carolina Commons project, another small subdivision along called Wheeler Oaks Project on Homestead Road, the Wan Buddhism Temple, Twin Creeks Park, Litchfield, and Tally Ho subdivisions. The staff recommendation is for the board to consider this request and to consider specifying follow-up action to the staff, such as directing the staff to prepare an analysis of this proposal in more detail, preparing a draft ordinance, proposing applicable boundaries or applicable types of projects, if any of those are the types of things that you're interested in doing. Happy to try and answer any questions.
I'm curious as to why this was referred to a number of advisory boards, but it was not referred to the Northern Transition Area, to the Small Area Advisory Board. It wasn't referred to those folks, and it wasn't referred to New Horizons. And since those two groups most represent the people in the northernmost part of this, I think that's a real oversight. And is there a reason why it wasn't referred to those groups?
Well, the planning board, I think it was, I mean, it may have just been a typo in that they didn't mention the Northern Transition Area. We actually distributed it to that commission and asked on the planning board, that is to say the staff distributed it to the Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee. But, James, I don't think the planning board intended to I think that the planning board chair can respond to this.
I think that group, I've heard from the group, and they're wondering why they were left out of the process and why they weren't asked to comment on it. And I think New Horizons should have had a chance to comment on it, too. Those two groups represent the bulk of the people that live out there.
Well, perhaps if we could ask the planning board chair to come up and address not only that topic, but just the request in general, if you have some remarks.
Actually, I think we did suggest, we did refer to the Northern Transition Area.
I've heard from the Northern Transition Area Advisory Board that they were not requested to comment on this.
Well, I entirely agree that both the Northern Transition Area and the New Horizons should be enabled to comment on this. I think this is an important decision, and as you say, they represent the folks out there more than anybody else. So I'm not sure how to address that exactly at this point, but you're entirely correct. So to back up a little bit then to the bigger picture, the history, The important context for this is that we essentially have a growth boundary that's established by the rural buffer zoning and by the urban services agreement, which says this is how far Chapel Hill and Carborough can grow and no further. And at the time, the area we call the Northern Study Area was identified as the area where Carborough could grow, and later on, the small area plan process, which was finally adopted in 1999, talked about the kind of character that folks wanted to see out there. What's taken place since then are a number of particular things have given character to that, and generally the kind of development that has happened has been almost entirely residential. And it has been fairly low density. We've only seen one exercise of the village mixed-use floating zone, and there are many who felt that it wasn't even the most suitable place for that intensity of development to occur.
I think that's a safe statement, though.
So we have in the planning board been seeing a lot of projects come in this area, and at times we have asked the developers, well, would you consider using the village mixed use? Would you consider, now that we have conditional use zoning, requesting something more intense? And we haven't gotten any positive response to that. Most folks don't want to do a rezoning. And so what the planning board felt, and we have heard other folks, including members of the Board of Aldermen, say that it looks like we're approaching build-out. We're facing a continuing problem with affordability. And are there steps that we could take to address this? And specifically at your retreat in February, you agreed to undertake a formal process to revisit the zoning in the area, to revisit zoning and ordinance. And the planning board is suggesting the moratorium is one way to go about that. We feel that there is some urgency because there really is not that much left. And as time passes on, these developments are coming forward. The demand for the kind of housing that's been happening out there is continuing. So that's in a nutshell what why we thought this was important.
Alex,
just to follow on with some of James's background, the idea was discussed back not just in this retreat but in the previous retreat, yeah, of actually establishing a process to actually identify tracts that would be appropriate for the various categories that have been outlined in the small area plan. And that's, you know, kind of got caught up in the whole floating zone concept. And if folks will remember a little bit of the history behind that was that concept was agreed upon because it was felt that at that time, the process of trying to actually rezone individual tracts would be both cumbersome and contentious, and it would be very difficult to move forward with implementation of even just the basic principles. However, I think we've agreed since that time that for the reasons that James has described, that the time is now appropriate to take that next bite from the apple, if you will. What we haven't gotten to, though, is figuring out a process by which we're going to do that. And we've discussed the concept and the idea, but we really need to figure out how we're going to go about this. Because I think some of the hazards are still there, and it's still going to be difficult to do, even though I agree it needs to be done. So, I mean, on first blush, I think, Jackie, your point is absolutely well taken, that perhaps the first next step in this process should be to solicit input from both the Northern Transitionary Advisory Committee and the New Horizons Task Force on how we should go about doing the whole thing and whether or not they think that the use of a moratorium in which as a mechanism to buy us some time in which to do that would be useful. I think it's premature to take it to public hearing yet because we haven't heard back from those folks. Your point is very well taken. So I'm not trying to cut off the conversation, mm-hmm, here. I'm just suggesting, uh-huh, that's kind of what we need to do before we do anything else. Uh-huh. James, would you agree with that? Yeah.
Sounds right.
And
Dan,
I would assume New Horizons meets on Monday, and I assume NTA meets sometime this month, and you know we can get that feedback fairly expeditiously. I have a question for staff, which has to do with how much latitude we have for a moratorium in defining the boundaries of where the moratorium would be. I mean, you know, we have a big swath here, and it might be that not all of it concerns us. And I'm also specifically thinking of two properties that I don't think we would want to have a moratorium on. One is the county property for the school site, which actually Mark had commented on that to me earlier, and the other is UNC property at the Horace Williams property where Carolina North applications might be coming in. Those are two projects I don't think we would want to constrain in a moratorium. And so, you know, the question is how can we draw the line further in there and further in at the top if we wanted to?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask Mike to jump in. I'm just going to say one thing, which is I believe you can redraw. I mean, the boundary doesn't have to be the northern study area boundary. I think the only thing will be making sure that whatever reason the moratorium is being established, there would have to be a connection between the boundary and the reason, the explanation for it, the justification for it. Currently, the boundary I think the planning board selected was because they used the plan and the policies and objectives and so forth of the plan as in its entirety to justify the proposal. And so I don't know if Mike, I'm sure he has something to add on this topic because he's much more of an expert on the legal issue of moratoria than I am.
Well, I don't have much to add to what Drew said. I think that's right. I think we do have a new statute, as he pointed out, and one of the things that the statute says is that any ordinance establishing a moratorium set forth a clear statement of the problems or conditions necessitating the moratorium and what courses of action alternative to a moratorium were considered by the city and why those alternative courses of action were not deemed adequate. So you've got to have, I think what the new statute has done as part of the old statute, I think, or the lack of the old, there was no old statute, is that you now have to have, I think, a more clear statement of what you're seeking to accomplish, what the problem is, what you've done to deal with the problem apart from the moratorium, why you have to have a moratorium, what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, they have to be.
Could we do something as simple as defining the problem as a problem pertaining to privately owned property?
I think in answer to your question, I don't think there's a particular problem with doing that. I think you could have a moratorium on that would either be geographically focused that would deal with the issue or possibly even exempting certain types of development, such as schools, for example, from the moratorium. I think either way one could, since as Trish points out, since the issues that I've heard that there's some desire on the part of the planning board to address are not that those issues do not arise in connection with the school or with the Chapel Hill North project, there'd be no reason to include those projects or those areas or those properties or those uses in a proposed moratorium that is designed to address something else. So I don't see that as a problem. I think the most significant issue that I would ask the board to consider is maybe having a pretty clear idea of what it is the moratorium would seek to accomplish and some idea of what you can't really just do anymore is just say, well, we've got a problem, we're going to study it for some indefinite period. You can't do that anymore. You've got to have much more focused in terms of both time and what the objectives are. And for example, it says that one of the other things you've got to have is a clear statement of the actions and the schedule for those actions proposed to be taken by the city during the duration of the moratorium to address the problems or conditions leading to the imposition of the moratorium. So there's a lot more procedural rigmarole and sort of contemplation of the objectives and timetables and schedules and things like that that we haven't had to have before and that the statute now requires.
We do have two people signed up to speak. I don't know, in light of this conversation, whether you all still want to address us, but come on up if you do. Let's Omar and Adam's in.
One at a time.
Go ahead.
Good evening, everyone. Just wanted to, I didn't really have too much prepared tonight because I was a little bit shocked when I saw the M word in the paper this morning. I guess I'm thinking that us as developers are doing a good job with, putting some dense projects with a lot of open space and affordable housing. And in these areas we speak about, and honestly, I think we need to think, well, what are we going to do commercial and retail out there? What can we support out there right now? You look at Metamont, Southern Village, and locations on Weaver Dairy Road. I mean, those merchants are dying out there. I just don't think we right now have the population center to demand that we do something like that out there. you know, I mean, I just want to make a couple requests before the next step hopefully isn't taken, I guess, is my proposal here. You know, we have a subdivision, Claremont Phase 2. There's others. There's Litchfield. There's the Tally-Ho Project. There's Carolina Commons. You know, and you guys are basically asking us to stop in our tracks. Right now we're in the concept review process, which is a lengthy process with the town of Carrboro. I mean, we've been in it for years. We've got, you know, a lot of money invested. We've got engineers hired. We have land under contract. We have pending properties. And just to say, hold on, guys, wait a year. Let us do this moratorium. Let us get this right. I mean, I just don't think there's real fairness. And quite honestly, the process in Carrboro is a long and lengthy and difficult process. And I think the process starts at a different level than what Trish is said here before. You know, and even what makes it even tougher for me to swallow is that, you know, I think our subdivision, Claremont and Claremont Phase 2 and Windmore, I think we're accomplishing a lot of the small area goals. I mean, we're putting in dense housing, surrounding it with open space, putting a lot of affordable housing in there. And a lot of these properties, and I think going through this map here, there's only some that would be viable commercial properties anyway. I mean, Trish, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't you need a certain amount of acreage to qualify for a mixed-use development?
50.
Well, there are a couple of different categories. The question is, I can't answer it in a general sense, because we have several categories. And
right.
So you could do one with as little as 4 acres. Actually,
but realistically, there has to be a parcel of land that's right for mixed use. I mean, we're providing a lot of duplex units and townhomes and single family product. You know, I just don't think a moratorium is the way to accomplish the goals of the small area plan. I mean, it makes more sense to identify properties that you guys want that would be commercial and mixed-use sites down the road, because I just don't think, honestly, that you can support it right now. And then perhaps do some rezoning with those and not stop this process midstream. A moratorium just seems to me to be for a desperate situation. I don't think this is a desperate situation. I think this is just an ordinance that needs some tweaking. I honestly don't know where this is coming from. I mean, I don't hear citizens and... You know, I mean, I don't think it's coming from you guys. I mean, this may be a concoction of the planning board, but I just, you know, where's it coming from? That's all I got.
Thanks.
Thank you guys for listening.
And I don't have a whole lot to add to that. I think Adam pretty much summed it up. I think ultimately most of the new construction in the Chapel Hill Carrboro area is in Carrboro these days, and I think that's where we're going to continue to see the growth in new construction. I think that if you just cease development, we're going to have a decrease in supply. And if you limit your supply, you are going to certainly have an increase in the cost of housing. I think that would be one of the negative effects of a moratorium. I think it's also, kind of to close up, for someone who has land under contract, who's been working through the preliminary review process before arriving at CUP, which can take anywhere from 6 to 12 months, it just doesn't seem fair to kind of stop that individual in their tracks. I wouldn't say to Mark, hey, Mark, you can't sell real estate for a year. You know, I think you need to think of the overall big picture. If rezonings are an interest, I think, you know, rezonings can be a path that's followed. I don't think that the town of Carrboro needs to stop everyone in their tracks. So that's all I have to say.
Thanks. Thanks, Omar. That was all the people who were signed up on the matter.
I just want to remind folks that the New Horizons Task Force survey reflected a very keen interest on the part of residents to see more commercial, and that came out in the PowerPoint last week. So I just want to remind folks that, yes, indeed, residents in that area have, you know, shared that interest.
Alex, I would just add, while I generally take a dim view of the General Assembly mucking about in our business, that the statutes that Mike just described hopefully will give us in this enterprise some more focus in terms of, again, figuring out the process of how we're going to go about this task and providing a clear timeline. Something that I had a problem with in the whole small area planning process was how damn long it took. And just, I hope that people understand, at least from my perspective, I'm not interested in doing that again. That we're going to need to define what our goals are, define our process, and move through it expeditiously. If a short moratorium is a device that'll, again, perhaps buy us some a reasonably short window of time in which to accomplish that goal, so that we don't, in the process, in going through our process, trigger a rush through the door to try to essentially get in the door before we get the work done, I think it can be a useful mechanism. But obviously, as has been mentioned earlier, we just need to hear from both of those groups before we do anything else, in my view.
Dan.
Yeah, I guess I agree with Alex, and I think that we should maybe be prepared when this comes back to us to have that conversation very specifically about what objectives we'll want Mike to put into a draft ordinance. And I'd like to make a motion that we refer this to the two committees, advisory boards that Jackie mentioned, and for discussion at their next meeting, and that we take this up again at our earliest subsequent business meeting.
Well, does this also need to be referred to the county and Chapel Hill?
I think it is appropriate to send this on to the county for sure, since this is an area of joint planning. I don't know that they need to particularly take any action, but I think just out of courtesy.
Is Chapel Hill included in this one or not?
I don't know.
If you do establish, if it results in a draft ordinance to establish a moratorium, to enact one, I mean, the procedure would be we will send it to Orange County as part of that process because it is treated as a text amendment. So they receive it 30 days prior to the public, at least 30 days prior to the public hearing. The staff does, and then they evaluate it. They've seen all of the moratoria. The ordinance is dealing with moratoria. It doesn't go as a report or any other communication to the Board of County Commissioners, and we have never, directly contacted the Chapel Hill Town Council with regard to any moratoria.
Let's explicitly send a copy of this at this early stage to the Board of County Commissioners. They own us. Significant amount of property out in that area.
Yeah, bear
let's
in
do
mind,
that now.
Absolutely. And bear in mind as well that if we get to the point where we're actually rezoning tracts, that's going to require amendments to the joint planning agreement and going to require the sign off of the county. So
at least
they're going to. This
doesn't affect Chapel Hill.
This is in. I can never remember.
Right, this is in the joint planning area between us and Orange County.
Okay.
And Chapel Hill has its joint planning area with Orange County as well, but the two do not overlap.
If it's consistent with the land use plan, joint planning area land use plan, and the then it would not have to go to all three.
Right.
If the land use plan needs to be changed because of the zoning changes, then it would have to go to Chapel Hill as well as Orange County.
So we should give them a heads up that this is going on.
It certainly wouldn't hurt anything to
put
a postage stamp on it to Chapel Hill Town Hall. So let's also do that. And I suppose that this matter has already come to the university's attention. But perhaps it would
put them on the CC list.
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate.
So you had a motion?
That sounded like a motion, but I wanted to comment on the whole thing just for 1 minute here and say, you know, as I when I went through Lake Hogan Farms, one of the things that I very consistently heard from residents in Lake Hogan Farms was the same point that you raised earlier, Randy, that there's a desire to see some commercial development out in that area. Of course, you know, nobody wants it right next to them, but there was some interest in that type of thing, even if it was as simple as a coffee shop, that there was this feeling that there was really in Northern Carrboro, other than a convenience store and an auto mechanic, that there was nothing in the entire northern half of our town that was commercial in nature. And there was interest. Some people expressed interest in a grocery store. I don't know how, you know, commercially viable that would be. But there was a lot of interest in seeing some more shopping opportunities in the northern area. And while I agree with, and I'm interested in what the planning board is discussing in terms of village mixed use, I think we need to look at that issue outside of village mixed use as well. That is to say, I don't think we should just assume that we will that any commercial rezonings would be exclusively as a part of village mixed use site. That's my thought.
I had a comment on that as well, which was this kind of struck me when I was reading the Daily Tar Heel this morning. I don't know if you saw Eric's article there, but he kind of led saying Northern Carrboro is about to get more commercial. And I read it and I say, well, we don't know that.
Right.
You know, we're getting the draft of our economic strategy today, you know, and maybe that'll tell us something about that. But, you know, I think Mr. Zinn's concerns are certainly well put, or well received, at least by me, that, you know, we don't know what the population up there will support, but we need to figure that out.
Right.
And I did, you know, have a conversation recently with Mary Rabinowitz, who's on the New Horizons Task Force, and her thinking was, well, even something that would have some synergy with the high school, like up at Cedar Falls near East High School, you know, would provide some of what we're talking about. You know, that's just one idea. But I think the point is that once we get people's heads together, which a moratorium might allow us to do, then we'll get our best thinking out on this and find out what's possible.
Regardless of whether we do a moratorium, I think it really is time for the board to have a very to put forward and adopt an aggressive plan for doing this work, and we need to identify what that process would be and go through it. Certainly, we'd be required to in a moratorium, but regardless of whether we do this is.
Are we going to screw around for 2 years with this?
It's time exactly.
To get off the pot.
You're right. Absolutely right.
Is the moratorium the only vehicle we have to do this?
Well, I think that's the kind of issue that we probably need to discuss when we get this back, hopefully sometime in November. I'm not sure.
Is Dan's motion still alive?
It's not seconded.
Seconded. Okay. Everybody remember what that motion was?
No.
Yeah, but it has to be.
It's to
refer the matter to the New Horizon Task Force, the Northern Transition Advisory Board, the county, Chapel Hill, and the university, and take this and also let them know that we'll be considering this at our next business meeting after the next scheduled meeting of New Horizons and the NTAB.
Okay.
Second.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The matter passes unanimously. So we will take up the question of whether to proceed after those various parties mentioned have a chance to give us some input and feedback on this topic. Hopefully we'll pick it up sometime in November. Keep looking at the manager to see how his reaction to my saying November is, but getting no reaction.
It depends on when we get the information back from the two advisory boards, but I think probably either November 14th or the 21st, assuming that we hear from New Horizons and the Northern Transition Area Board in that time frame.
Okay. Before we're on agenda item D6. Before we dive into this topic, it says discussion of a request from Planning Board regarding a step back provision of the Downtown Neighborhood Protection Overlay District. Could I just ask for some clarification about whether this is notably different than the issue that we decided not to hold a public hearing on a month ago?
Trish, I mean, I think it is different, but I'll let Trish respond.
This is different. The issue you decided to not hold a public hearing on dealt with the street right-of-way. This is about, and the mechanism that's in the ordinance presently states that the right-of-way needs to be a certain size in order for building, a building to be of a certain height. And on a lot that has frontage on multiple streets, on multiple street rights-of-way, the narrowest right-of-way is what determines the building height for the entire lot. And the request that was made to you was to change the ordinance so that rather than having to...
And we declined to even hold a hearing on
that. We declined to hold a hearing on this. This request is about... Is about something different, a different provision, and
Yeah, I guess.
But it's not. I mean, it's different in the details, but I think the principle stands that we went through a year of working out the details of the protection of the protection area. The Planning Board was intimately involved in that. We had a public hearing on that, and this is about kind of the same property that I know people have been having conversations outside of meetings about, and I am tired of seeing, I'm feeling kind of...
frustrated.
Yeah, I'm looking for proper words.
Take a minute.
We went through a long time of creating this, and everybody had input into it, and everybody signed off on it. That was a really hard group with very different people with very different opinions, and everybody in that group came to agreement. And because some members of the group are in positions where they can bring different ideas up and advocate for ideas separately, I don't like it. And this board voted on it. This community went through an awful lot with the whole downtown change. And we're trying to come up with ways of protecting the neighborhoods, and over again be asked to change that protection. I find it really bothers me. So I hope that my statement wasn't ambiguous.
Jackie, I think your concern is very legitimate, and I know you work very hard with folks in the community to go through this. Help me understand from this request what is threatening the safety of the neighborhoods or
what we agreed on over a long period of time. It's asking to have one of the step backs removed. And that was all, like, really hammered out over a long period of time.
I think if I could jump in for a second, I guess the concern is that it seems like we struck a compromise, and now that compromise, the rubber hits the road on that compromise, we're being asked once a month to go back and revisit that compromise and tinker with it, and it, you know, I don't know anything about the merits of the proposed change here, really, but it doesn't feel right to be constantly badgered about making changes to this.
Thank you.
It's my gut reaction.
Two points of clarification.
Sure. One is this and the other item that you all mentioned about the streetscape was they were both on for a prior agenda. You all asked that this one come back for further discussion. That's the first point. The second point, I want to be very clear that this was initiated by the planning board, and this is not the staff bringing this back on its own initiative.
I am clear about that.
My comments are not directed towards the staff.
Okay, I just want to be clear.
Not directed towards the staff. They're directed towards who's where the initiation is coming from.
Mark, I have a question.
Well, go ahead, and then let's hear the presentation. I apologize.
Okay. Trish, you may answer this. Are you going through some of the diagrams when you?
Yes.
Okay.
Then I'll hold.
Okay.
Trish, correct me if I'm reading this wrong, but kind of in response to Jackie's point, if I'm reading the agenda item correctly, that this item did come before the board not last month, but a year ago on August 23rd, and was proposed and rejected at that time. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if it'd be helpful to just go through the presentation. And there was no lengthy. There were discussions of a number of topics. This one came up, the fact is that it was not adopted, and so in that sense, it was rejected. I don't know if it was examined in any particular way. Okay.
Of the adoption of the overall.
Yes,
in other words,
correct.
It was one of the issues discussed in.
Yes, that's correct.
At the time that we were moving toward adoption of the downtown neighborhood program.
That's correct.
Yeah, just to try to pull back, I'm not really sure if there's a lot of value in sort of assigning motives and this kind of stuff here. I mean, the proposal has merits. I think people have made good points about procedurally how this is kind of problematic, given that, as you've pointed out, that we did go through a lengthy process and compromises were made, and so that's kind of what we're working with, and we kind of said that that's what we would work with. I mean, my personal bias and inclination is that on its merits, this is kind of sensible, but given what's been, again, given the process from a procedural standpoint, you know, I would tend to agree. I think we ought to give it more time to work. I mean, obviously, any series of ordinances that we come up with are going to be adjusted over time. We're going to see flaws. This, however, is new enough that perhaps it would be more prudent to give it more time to work as it's currently promulgated.
And clearly, it would be bad to make a major mistake in the design of one of our downtown buildings. And I know we all agree on that point. And I'm really not trying to get to the merits of this issue, but I've got to say, anyway, I already said it, but, you know, starting to feel a little bit badgered about this. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm just going to skip, actually. I have a couple of pictures to show you. You don't really need the overview. It's in the abstract and what's happening with the DNP, unless you want me to go back over that, but I think you all are pretty clear on it.
Yes.
Okay. So the issue that the Planning Board has brought to your attention is the fact that basically the way the DNP overlay works is that where you face the residential zone, if you're it's in the CT or the M1 or the B1C and the B1G, you can do two stories, and you can do a third story if you step it back 10 feet or if you do a building, a different roof line. And then you are also required to do a 10-foot step back, what we call a step back, on the opposite side of the building. So this is the way it would look if you were on a lot where there's, you don't have a street right of way on this side. And what the effect of that is that when you get to a situation where you can have some additional building height, if the building is not near a street right of way, you can do this. You're required to step in that third story on the opposite side, but then you can make the fourth and fifth stories meet the rest of the building, the bottom part of the building. And so the planning board was concerned about whether this was a design issue that would be problematic, and it would result in, I think, the building being cut off and the less building massing on those upper stories. And then if you go to a street right-of-way situation, again, you have this opposite side step back. And then depending on your street right-of-way, et cetera, this is assuming you can max out your upper stories, your fourth and fifth stories in the B1C and the B1G. You could pop your building, you do your roofline thing on the fourth story and then the fifth story, and you end up with just something that looked a bit odd to them when they saw this as the as illustrations of how the ordinance could work, I think. And James is here to talk about and you've heard, of course, you've heard the planning board folks, they've seen their recommendation. So this is what they're concerned about. That provision.
And the essence of the proposed changes is to do away with that sort of notch requirement?
Yes, that is the request.
Okay.
That is the essence of the revised recommendation.
But what would happen if they did away with that? What were then, are then their other options?
Well, if the third story is going to be determined by whatever the zoning is on this side, outside of the buffer area. And so you're allowed to have three stories.
You could on the other side, you would be able to come flush.
Yes,
to that,
you'd be able to come flush at the third floor, and then you have to deal with your fourth and fifth stories, depending on how much street right of way you have, or if you're on a lot that doesn't have any street right of way, you're on a lot that's away from a street right of way, and
conditional to those.
Anyway, you would go back to the provisions that apply to the fourth and fifth stories, the third, fourth, and fifth stories as for the underlying zoning. In essence, what you'd be able to do is make your building go all the way out to there, and you wouldn't have the notch. That's what
you just have a straight wall.
The architectural standards.
If we're somewhat clear about what the proposal or request is, could I again call on the planning board chair to comment on this issue, and then we have one speaker signed up.
And there, but let me just interject that there is another point about increasing the tower height that Trish didn't address. Is that correct?
Well, that was part of the planning board's request initially when they read.
But it's not any longer.
Well, I think James could respond, but the planning board, when they revised that recommendation in June of this year. Or I guess it was June of this year, they didn't include the tower height piece. They did have a brief discussion.
That's not
of
in
it.
The ordinance sections that are cited in Attachment C. So.
Okay.
No.
Right.
No, they
right.
didn't.
So
the planning board didn't reiterate
that's
that part of the request.
Okay.
Right.
This was a recommendation that we made at the time you considered the original DNP overlay, but it wasn't discussed in your conversation, and it's the main thing I want to say about it is it has no impact whatsoever on the neighborhood side, none whatsoever. It doesn't change any of the things that we all agreed on. I'm not exactly sure how this particular piece got in, which says that to get this third story in the DNP, you have to step back. But in order to do that, you also have to step back on this side. It really doesn't make any sense for that step back to drive what happens over here. The only way you can see it from over there is with the periscope and mirrors and so on. But on the other hand, and I look at this as a designer and an artist, and I think what they're going to respond to this, and this is the kind of structure that we're likely to get, people who want to maximize the use of the space. So it's a very, very mundane and simple change, I think, that, again, I will say, I believe has no effect whatsoever on what we worked so hard to put together to get what we wanted on the neighborhood side.
It seems to me, James, that one, you know, that partly built into, and I just think we ought to really explicitly lay it out there. One of the assumptions that's built into that is that, you know, that every developer would or should or will want to build absolutely everything that they could possibly build on their lot. And, you know, I admit that is a very strange diagram, but my question, part of my question would be, well, why would, is there really any danger that anybody would build that? Or well, or be so foolish as to propose to build that, let me say.
Perhaps not. But the way then to create an attractive building is that you have to sacrifice what the ordinance otherwise allows you anywhere else.
Because you're opposite residential
because,
on the other side.
Yeah, because anybody with an aesthetic sense is not going to make that notch. They're just going to step back and they're going to go straight up. But they're going to be sacrificing square footage, which otherwise we've already agreed that we wanted them to utilize.
This is, I got to say that I'm, again, you know, you have a point, but you have not latched on to the worst part of this compromise by bringing this up. The worst part is that the kind of mansard roofs that are shown on that diagram are permitted under this. All of the worst-looking buildings in Carrboro have mansard roofs, and I think it is, if we're going to get back into this, I, at least for one, would want to revisit
that
question.
I mean, should that be connected?
Well, it gets to all the same, you know, step-back issues and, mm-hmm. and roof line and all of that. I can't imagine being in that house and wanting to look at this, like, 70-degree angle roof, series of 70-degree angle roofs up above me, personally. The same issue was brought forward at the time as to why we should allow that is, well, you know, the developer's return on investment needs, you know, the developer needs to be able to squeeze in as much space as humanly possible. And I'm like, you know.
Since when is it our job to make people
you know,
but they will.
Don't aesthetics ever enter into this? And, I mean, I know you agree with me that they do and they really should. I realize that. But I find this topic frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Ripperton has signed up to speak. You don't have any comments, okay. Board members.
I just want to say that the notching, I think, is a real problem. I think, I agree with the planning board that the on the residential side, it's taken care of. The problem is the opposite side. And why would we want to paint ourselves into a corner by, you know, creating language that insists on having that notch when we don't have to do that? A lot of time was spent on thinking about architecture and architectural vernacular and making sure that, you know, that the appearance commission would be involved, and here it sits right in front of us where we could be making a difference in a very simple way.
Well, let me suggest, and thoughts are just now occurring to me, but I'd be willing to get rid of the notches if y'all would be willing to get rid of the mansard roofs.
I'll do that.
I mean, frankly, I do not, having, you know, been, and Jackie was there too, I do not recall what reasoning gave rise to this particular peculiar artifact. I think it is, as I think what James is pointing out, it is a peculiarity of that arose from a discussion that was designed to address other stuff.
What only arises if you're trying to squeeze absolutely every square inch out and have five stories of expensive condos.
And well, they will.
Yeah, but the you know, as was discussed, though, that the idea was to address the visual impact on the adjoining residential zones. And so this effect takes place outside the DNP buffer zone, which would be
thing out there, though.
Which would be adjoining a commercial. Now, if there were another residential zone on the other side, then all of those step-backs would apply. So, I mean, it would still work if that were the case. But in this case, it seemed, I mean, that's what I said earlier, that on the merits of it, the proposal seemed to make sense. I share the concerns that other people have with monkeying around with us after it took us so long to put it together. However, I'm convinced that in substance, that this is more an artifact of omission or error. Basically, somebody didn't catch it, and that's why it's popping up.
They don't have to build that little thing sticking out there. That would give them what, like 30 more square feet, you know? I mean, how greedy are people? They don't have to build that.
I just love the civil tone that
well,
seems to
I'm getting kind of tired. You don't have to.
Yeah, everybody's a villain.
No, not everybody. I'm not.
Yours are all so clear to you.
I see the there's not much. I can see the I can feel the anger of kind of rewriting the process of.
Because what's going to be next?
Of revisiting that, but what do we lose? What do we gain? What's the cost benefit analysis here? I mean, we're trying to expand commercial space as a goal of the board. In a way also that it protects the neighborhood, right? Or is this only benefits the developer and not the taxpayers?
You know, but only the ground floor is required to be commercial, you know, is the mm-hmm. other thing. So, I mean, I it seems as a practical matter that the direction that things are headed is that the third floor is going to be residential.
And how much longer are we going to be able to hold on to even having the ground floor be commercial before it's requested that be turned into... to residential.
That's coming on our...
Yeah.
So this apparently came up in the courtesy review of the Andrews Rigsby project. So I'm trying to imagine standing on... It was a car street mm-hmm. that goes next to that and, you know, where we would have it step back because of the residential area. And I can't really get a sense of how the opposite side is laid out would affect... my relationship to that building. And similarly, if I was standing on the Roberson Street side, I don't see how the fact that it's residential on the opposite side of Carr Street would affect my relationship to the building. So, I don't see, you know, I guess I kind of agree with Alex that, you know, I understand Jackie's and Mark's annoyance with the changes coming up. And I want to also acknowledge that I wasn't part of all that hard work to iron this out. So I want to, like, give deference to that sensibility.
Oh, yeah, it's nice to have another set of eyes on it occasionally.
But anyway, you know, lacking a reason for this, you know, I just don't see what the problem is with the change.
Do we know what Alderman Joe Brown thinks about this?
I haven't heard from her. I haven't heard from her about this issue. I don't know whether.
I think she's at Lion King tonight, isn't she?
We could page her.
Right. I've got her cell number.
Just procedurally, where we're at now is merely a request to set.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, based on what I've heard, I'm inclined to at least move forward to that part, and we can go ahead and hash it out and have a full discussion. and hear from the public about what they think. If there's a real substantive issue here, then, yeah, let's hear it.
Okay, so we'll hear from the public on all of this.
Okay, well, then can I at least not necessarily integral to this proposal, but can I ask that we at least also set at the same time the opportunity to revisit the question of mansard roofs as a part of our downtown? And, you know, we'll, I guess all I'm saying is if I'm being asked to vote again on this topic, I want to vote again on that topic, too.
Yeah.
And I do think it's interrelated with with what the request here is.
Do you want us to, you know, prepare an ordinance provision that would do that? Because other than having separate hearings and the cost of those and so forth.
A little bit of language in the existing ordinance. And I think that could probably be done as one public hearing. But maybe we would have two separate ordinances since we probably have slightly different
votes. I think that gets a little more complicated in the language because that involves, I mean, that involves, there's a bunch of language in there that deals with concealing a story behind a roof structure, which functionally, in some respects, does give rise to the mansards that you discussed. But that changes the matrix. I think that changes the matrix of the whole thing. I'm not saying that your point is invalid.
I don't know how complicated what I'm saying is. I have to admit, I don't really.
I didn't come prepared
with a set of photos of various mansard roofed buildings in Carborough that I should have had with me a year ago, and so I will come more prepared next time. if we can, so I don't know. We need a motion.
Well, what I'm moving actually, since this is to take this particular item to public hearing, that's all I'm going to move. And
I'll second that.
But I'm not adverse to investigating your concern either.
Mm-hmm. I will vote for this if we agree to send out notification, okay, because I know we usually don't for this, but to send out notification to everybody that lives within 1,000 feet of the zone that's under consideration. Because often when we do this, it's not covered under the notification of people that live within 1,000 feet. And this has a great effect on the whole downtown, on the whole community. So let's do it so that people don't go, wow, oh, I didn't hear that. Let's send it out.
What's that the ordinance requires? I mean, it sounds like a good idea and should be. So maybe we should change the ordinance.
For some reason, it doesn't go out under this kind of issue. It only goes out for like a CUP.
For an individual development.
Yeah, for an individual development.
What would be the normal, what would you normally do as far as notice?
We only do mailed notices for rezonings and permit applications, and there are different distances associated with special use and conditional use permits. But for a text amendment, it's a published notice requirement,
which is such a huge thing.
What would you normally do for a rezoning?
A rezoning has a 1,000-foot notification. So for the DNP overlay zone, there was a 1,000-foot notification, a mailing to folks within 1,000 feet.
So this should go to everybody that got it for the overlay zone because it's affecting that.
It was 35 pages of mailing labels that we used for that here. I'm only going to say that I don't know whether it would be helpful to try and merge these. If you are thinking of changing the mansard definition, trying to link them together because I don't know if you'd want to do a mailed notice for that as well and have a separate.
Precisely because of the
notice. Yeah, let's merge them. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you on the roof.
I don't know what the urgency or timing might be. Of it, but I mean concerns related to the timing of it. But it will be—it's a significant effort and a fair amount of cost associated with it.
It's a significant issue. It's how the downtown looks and feels and what it's going to be like.
Why don't we combine these two issues into one hearing and do that level of notice?
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be,
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Inclined to vote for this motion the way it's crafted now, frankly.
We would need to revise a draft ordinance to address the issue of the mansard and the.
I assume there'd be a way to do that, so that they're sort of the ordinance that we would have at public hearing would be part A that achieves a certain objective and Part B that achieves a different objective. And if it was the board's pleasure to adopt only one or the other of Part A or B, we then we kick one of those out of the ordinance. But as long as it's as long as they're both put out there and advertised as subject for the public hearing, then they're both available topics for adoption or rejection.
So can you be a little bit more explicit about what you're asking staff to draft regarding the mansard roof issue?
Right now, I mean, all I'm saying is we ought not to permit the mansard roofs as a part of because the issue is in part, if I understand it correctly, that basically the step back requirement, that if you build a mansard roof, you can count that as your step back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It's a substitute. Yeah, and it, or it could be a gable. It could be, you know, it just depends on what kind of a building you do. But a mansard obviously would be the way to get as much roof area, building area concealed within the roof.
And I guess so, my feeling is that a step back ought to be a step back, and that building in an incentive that and building in an incentive for people to build mansard roofs, which are, I think, not at all consistent with our downtowns.
No, this is getting all tangled up. You guys have dumped enough poison pills on the table that I'm going to withdraw the motion.
You said in this interest that the people...
Well, we don't have a motion before us.
I'm just concerned that if we start getting into... We're reopening...
I would like to move.
Now who's complaining about reopening the compromise? That's exactly what I'm talking about is,
well, I mean, I understand your perspective, but the point was that some of us were convinced that this was an artifact of oversight, right? Not a substance.
That's not true. We discussed both of these issues at that meeting back in August. We discussed how strange that notch out was. Right. We discussed that. We also spent time discussing about, and I tried to persuade the board that we ought to do differently when it comes to mansard roofs at that time. Both of those issues were on the table at the time.
But I think
that... And it was not omitted. Sure. We saw exactly that same diagram.
Yeah.
And we all went, what the hell is up with that diagram?
No argument there.
I have a motion. I'd like to move that we continue this discussion until our next meeting and give people some time to kind of think things to think things through.
That sounds reasonable.
Have a second? Would you second?
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded that we and should we set a specific date to you said our next meeting, is that
we
right?
We continue this 09 that we continue this until
we have a very busy agenda later in October.
Okay. The next two meetings are...
Okay. Can we pick it up November...
The original one was.
No.
Jackie just...
7th is... We're not meeting.
14th, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Right.
14th. After November 7th, we'll all be in such a better mood. So, yeah, let's do
hopefully.
It. Let's do it then. Yeah.
Okay. So the motion is to table this topic until November 14th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Okay. We're done with our printed agendas.
I didn't want to hurt anybody.
I can't handle
A couple of things very briefly that I need to ask the board about. I think you all have... many of the people in this room have given me annual performance reviews for our town manager, but some people have not. So for those of you who have not, I wasn't asking for anybody to be identified, but those of you who have not given me your review, please fill that out and get it back to me so we can...
Can I get another one? That slipped my mind. If somebody could just email me one, I will do it.
We'll make sure that happens.
I'm sorry. I just completely...
It's okay. I'm in the same boat with you, we'll review those sometime like November 14th or something. And the other thing, just briefly, we did not hear a lot of board reaction to the question of the really really free market is planning on proceeding this Saturday afternoon, and they did kindly or someone kindly filed for a permit and someone paid for it. I guess...
What time are they planning to...
It's like 1 to 5 okay. or something
so
like
it's
that.
After the road race. Okay.
I'm not certain about that, but we can find that out. The real question is that is about the need for insurance and serving food. And, you know, basically people have at past really, really free markets, you know, prepared food at home under unknown circumstances and brought it and given it away.
How dare they?
I tell you. but our insurance carrier is not willing to insure the situation, I guess is basically where it stands.
Well, I think that they have expressed a concern, and staff has a concern. It's really a policy issue, and if there were a claim, then the insurance company would look at the circumstances involved in the claim. But I think they've given the town advice as to what they think is appropriate, and if the town has a choice to make as to whether to follow that advice or not. It's really a policy decision for you. We think, you know, there's certainly exposure there, and if they don't have insurance, whatever exposure is there, because it's sanctioned by the town, is going to be the town's.
What happens when the Friends of the Library sell Rice Krispie Treats at Carbro Day? How is that covered? Is that because it's Carbro Day? And it's a town event that it's covered, even though Friends of the Library is selling it to raise money for their organization?
I believe that's a town-sponsored event, I believe, is the short answer.
They're not going to sell food. They're just going to have like this.
The issue is not selling. The issue is it doesn't matter if it's being sold or not.
It's
distributing.
The issue is the last time there were... Food was prepared in a variety of ways, and I'll just kind of leave it at that. And
some good, some not good.
Part of the litigious society. What was it our friend Bill Shakespeare said?
If it weren't for the food piece, I know the staff wouldn't. I don't believe our insurance carrier would have a particular problem with no insurance, but it's really the food piece that really creates the potential liability issue for the town. And you all need to decide if you're willing to accept that liability or not.
What would happen if the food was given out from the back of their cars and it wasn't town property, it was their car? I'm not kidding.
Where would said car be parked?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Town what?
You know,
I just want to say that I'm not comfortable with the idea of a town commons where I can't take a sandwich and tear off half of it and give it to my friend without insurance, which is basically what this boils down to. And
you make good sandwiches, yeah.
Actually, well, I don't. I never eat
you
that.
On the other hand, Dan,
that's sensible. We can't have that.
On the other hand, there's the issue, and I know that this has come up, and this is just one other way of looking at it, that, for example, very often E. coli is transferred on ice because people use their hands and, you know, shovel ice into big buckets or whatever, and unsuspecting folks pick it up in their drinks, and it either melts into their drink or they eat it. And I'm just going
to.
I have no idea, but the fact of the matter is, it happens, and it happens quite often, and that happens in restaurants. So, you know, I think there's cause to be concerned, since the town would hold full responsibility.
How big of a deal is it to really free market that we say, please don't give out food? Is that a huge deal? I mean, they seem to be giving out lots and lots of stuff. Is that a really big deal?
Well, it's a measurable component of what's being given away there.
Okay.
I mean, it is a, it's not it's not as though there's only one person or one or two people bringing food. And I think and that actually, you know, sort of adds to the problem from that point of view. I think it's a difficult subject because our, you know, as Alex alluded to, our society should not be this litigious. But the fact is that if something should happen, then what plaintiff's attorneys do is look for the deepest pockets. And it's not going to be, I guarantee you, it's not going to be the people who organize, if there are any people who organize the really, really free market.
Allegedly organized. Yeah.
Who organize the really, really free market. You know, that's not going to be the obvious defendant in the lawsuit. I think there's some information that in the past was posted to Orange Politics that really raises a question about the circumstances from which some of the food came. And I'm not going to say anything more than that on the microphone. But
okay.
Mark.
All right.
I mean, I...
Actually, I will. There, you know, there was a person who posted something on Orange Politics a while ago, a person who was connected with the really, really free market who referred to that he got the majority of his food by dumpster diving for it. And I'm not saying that that's how food finds it. I'm quoting the man. I'm not saying that necessarily is happening at the really, really free market.
Mark, I think you've just solved the problem right there. Ain't nobody going to show up now.
Yeah, right. All you do is badmouth the food and not nobody will eat it. I'll email y'all the link to that comment if you want. But
okay.
I mean, I frankly think that there have been points in the past where there was food that looked genuinely suspect at the really free market.
Okay.
Some. Mostly not. Overwhelmingly not.
Suspect.
But some. So,
So basically any kind of homemade looking,
I don't have a good answer to this.
Commercial food, right?
If folks are concerned about having really free food, you know, the Interfaith Food Council has specific guidelines, and if they want to get a free meal, there are places to get it that we know have very clear rules and regs for, you know, distributing free food.
I don't think that's what it's about.
I know it's not about
that. But I guess what I'm wondering is if we know what it would cost the town to have our own insurance indemnify us against the casual sharing of food on town property and illnesses resulting therefrom. Because you never know, someone might actually hand someone a piece of ice on town property too.
I think our insurance does cover that. The issue is we know in advance that this event is happening and these things are happening. And it makes it different than just two friends showing up and saying, "Here, have a sandwich." It really is a very different situation.
Well, how about this? Let's proceed at this point by asking the Parks and Rec staff to let people who attend the really, really free market know that food is not a permissible item there. And inform the people about that, and maybe even go so far as to post some notices that, in which we basically disclaim, you know, the quality of an event or that type of thing, and you know, move forward from that perspective for right now.
I defer to Mike, but I think that's a problem because we don't really have a prohibition against food. The issue is if they're reserving.
But you see what I'm saying is basically inform them that, you know, you really can't, without insurance, you cannot be distributing food here.
And yeah, we could do
post
that.
Post a sign saying,
"This is unauthorized."
The town of Carver does not sanction distribution of food at this event, and there's no insurance to cover these activities so far as the town is aware, that type of thing, and leave it at that for the moment while we kind of explore this topic a little further.
This is one of those battles where commercial capital doesn't win.
Sure. Plaintiff's attorneys, anyway.
Oh, why don't we just have somebody hand out a dysentery disclaimer and people can sign it as they walk in the door?
Well, commercial capitalism hasn't been doing that great a job of protecting our food sources lately, has
it?
Nope.
That's
move we adjourn.
Okay, as long as they don't distribute organic spinach.
There were some neighbors, including my wife, who works, and myself, we walked through the Honhalo private driveway, you know, to take the kids to school. And the owner, Mr. Dwyer, he closed, there was some vandalism in his property, and he closed, he put some, how do you call that, sawhorses to close the access to, at the end of Honhalo, and the bike path that we, that connects, you know, Autumn Drive with Honhalo, which is a path used by many parents in the morning to take their kids to school. And I remember when we had a discussion about Carborough Greens, that he specifically said he was willing to maintain public access to. He was going to divert, dedicate some land and divert the current path that exists today. So given that, and it's private property, and he has the right to protect his property, he has agreed, if somebody requests from him in writing by email, to let you walk through his property. His email is greenbuilder4s, it's greenbuilder4us@aol.com, and his name is
Tom Dwyer.
And so those folks who, many families contacted me from my neighborhood who were kids, was wondering what was happening there, that they can walk, cut through the Honhalo private drive. What they need to do is to contact Mr. Dwyer, and he will, I guess, allow you to walk through his property. Thank you so much, Steph, for getting back to me so quickly about this.
If there's nothing further, is there a motion to adjourn?
Second that?
Yeah.
Move.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, not passed unanimously.